In the name of God, who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Please be seated. May I begin by saying a very sincere and grateful thank you to Lee and to you, St. George's, for hosting me this week. I'm sure I go away with much more than I've left. And I'm not just talking about my girth. I've been well fed and just enjoyed so much being part of your faith journey and learning from what God is doing amongst you. Has God ever offended you? Have you been in the place where you thought, I could do a much better job running this universe than God is doing right now? 5 years ago, last week, we sat around our kitchen table Sunday evening after church, having our traditional tea and toast with a group of people we had gathered together. Among them was my friend Martin, Bishop Martin now, a school friend of mine. He was visiting. I had been his best man many years before, and 2 weeks later he had been my best man when he married Sarah. Sarah had died after a long struggle with cancer, and Martin took refuge in our home from time to time just to come and be with us when he was in Cape Town. Also sitting around the table that evening were our good friends James and Colleen Thomas. James had been served as my church warden on a number of times. James was a larger-than-life character. He'd breathed ideas and enthusiasm and was just about to set off on a trip to Nairobi to go and do some work there in training entrepreneurs and building job creation into deprived communities. We had a wonderful time around the table sharing what lay ahead for us in our various weeks, and we finished off the evening with an informal time just praying and asking God to be upon us as we went into the week. We didn't know, but that would be our last meal with James. He was killed in Nairobi on the Friday when Al-Shabaab burst into the Eastgate Mall and mowed down people in a terror attack. We were shattered. We were devastated. 5 tiny little bits of metal took down this huge, big, enthusiastic man of God who we had prayed for. Where was God? What had happened to our prayers? We felt abandoned. As part of the funeral service, which was a huge funeral service because many people were touched by James's life, Colleen led us in a lament. She asked the organist to play a chord on the organ, and then we all just cried out our anger and our sadness and our confusion. Maybe that story resonates with you in some way. Maybe it's something that you are experiencing right now. Maybe it's something from the past that touches you or relates to somebody you know well and are carrying on your heart. Well, today's readings speak into this situation. The Bible is not silent on this question of where is God in these moments of dereliction and suffering. Our Old Testament reading from Job sets the scene. Satan, like a prosecuting attorney, challenges God to show him one righteous person, and God says, Job's righteous. And Satan says, well, that's all very well for him. He's got everything he wants, but take it away and see what happens. And so in swift succession, Job loses everything, his wealth, his children. His wife loses her faith. She says to him, curse God and die. And Job replies in the ancient words which Jews and Christians have used over the centuries. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. It's a momentous acceptance of the will of God. And logically, the book should end there, but it doesn't. Job asks if he can test, Satan asks if he can test Job one more time. And this time, Job cracks. This time it all falls apart, and he curses the day he was born. And from then on, for the next 30 or so chapters, Job challenges God to show him why he deserves the suffering. And as the book rises to a crescendo, eventually, God, who has been silent, finally reveals himself to Job. And now we expect we'll get the answer to the question of all questions. Why does a good, loving God who is all-powerful allow suffering? But instead, for a full four chapters, God asks questions of Job, unanswerable questions. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have you gone to the gates of death? And every question, of course, is left unanswered. And then there's this astonishing reversal. Because God tells Job that he, who questioned God's justice, is right. And his so-called comforters, who try to justify God's justice, are wrong. What the book of Job does is legitimize for us asking questions. It says it's okay to cry out for justice. It is permitted to voice our indignation and offense at the way God is running the universe and our lives in it. But more than this, it's not only permissible, it's the right and commendable thing to do. God is angry with Job's comforters who try to defend God, not with Job, who God says spoke the truth. So it says to Colleen and to each one of us in our pain and our confusion, yes, you can call out for justice. Yes, you can shout out your indignation. Yes, you can say to God, I'm offended. Yes, you can rail against God and like a petulant toddler beat his chest in your frustration and anger. That, in fact, is the truthful thing to do. Now, that reflection sets the scene for us as we step into the gospel. The gospel reading ends with this poignant, just one verse. Jesus, when he had heard what had happened to John, withdrew by a boat privately to a solitary place. Can you imagine what was happening in Jesus at that moment? His cousin, his friend, the closest thing that he had to a human partner in his mission, the one of whom he said, among those born of woman, there is no one greater than John. This one, his dear friend, had now been killed by the convergence of human sin, Herod's depraved party boast and weak leadership, his lecherous, drunken friends, the scheming, manipulative wife, the young daughter enticed and entrapped in a system of sexual exploitation. All this, the worst of humankind, came together and like a tsunami swept away his friend and companion and left his body violated in death and his decapitated head the centerpiece and the debris of a debauched feast. What was going on in Jesus' mind as he withdrew to pray? Well, we're not told in the gospel, but the compilers of the lectionary have given us Psalm 26 to go alongside these two readings. And there's that poignant verse in the psalm, verse 3, which we have just heard the choir sing so beautifully. For your love is before my eyes. For your love is before my eyes. Another translation of that verse is, I have always been mindful of your steadfast love. It was that steadfast love that Jesus had affirmed to him as he began his ministry when he was baptized in the Jordan and the heavens opened and a voice spoke and said, this is my son whom I love. With him I'm well pleased. It was that same voice that affirmed the steadfast love of God when he was on the Mount of Transfiguration and about to begin his journey down to Jerusalem and to the cross and all that awaited him there. And the voice spoke again and said, "You are my son whom I love." It was that steadfast love that enabled Jesus to mourn his friend and companion, John, knowing that this was just a precursor for himself, because he too would take on the sin of the world, humanity at its worst, and he would drink that cup to the dregs. It was the steadfast love of the Lord that enabled Jesus to grieve. It was a steadfast love of the Lord that enabled the writer to Lamentations to land on this solid rock in the face of the siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar with untold misery. The writer of the Lamentations, and I may be, this is speculation, but maybe these were the words on Jesus' heart as he withdrew into that solitary place. He says he feels like God is using him as target practice. He's taking hit after hit. He says, "My soul is bereft of peace." And these poignant words, "I've forgotten what happiness is." My soul is bereft of peace. My hope from the Lord is gone. My soul continually remembers and is bowed down. That's the reality. That's the truth, and it is expressed in all its raw honesty. But then there's the turning point. Then there's the resting on another truth, a more solid truth. "Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness." Everything can burn down. Everything can be destroyed. But the one thing that remains sure is the steadfast love of the Lord. In Hebrew, the word is hesed. H-E-S-E-D, if you want to write it down. Hesed, which means the faithfulness of God, the steadfastness of God, the loyalty of God. God's love is so strong that it cannot be broken. And this love is not based on reciprocity, it's based on generosity. It's not love that we deserve, it's love that God gives because God is generous. In Hebrew culture, hesed is something you do. You act in hesed. God is hesed, and God's hesed is so hesed that it's beyond the covenant. Psalm 89 says, "The world is built on hesed. In the heavens you establish your hesed." The throne of God rests on it. I don't know if you've ever been out to a restaurant. Lee and Richard and I had this experience on Monday, and you sit at a table and the table is rocking, it's wobbling, and you have to call the waitron over to adjust it, slip something underneath so that it doesn't wobble anymore. Well, the rabbis say that God's throne was wobbling because one of the legs was too short, and God's throne was wobbling until God propped up his throne with hesed. If it were not for God's hesed, the throne of God would wobble, and the whole universe would wobble with it. If it were not for God's hesed, we would not be free to cry out how offended we are, or declare how badly we think God is running the show. If it were not for God's hesed, Jesus could not cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" If it were not for God's hesed, we would not be able We would not have been able to shout out our anger at James's funeral about what had happened to this man of God. It is God's hesed, it's God's loving faithfulness and kindness that saves us and saves you and me and Colleen from despair. But more than that, God's hesed saves the world from self-destruction. It saves us from destroying one another, from allowing anger and injustice to control us. Our world, my friends, is wobbling. My country, South Africa, is wobbling. We have a new president, thank the Lord. But we're still wobbling. There are service delivery protests every day. People are angry. Apartheid may be off the statute books, but it's not out of the hearts of the people. And unemployment is high, and people are scared. And so they retreat behind their electric fences and their walls and try to keep the others out and throw lobs over the wall. The world is wobbling. I've been in the UK recently and realized there's a divided nation. Brexit is just around the corner and they don't know what's going to happen. I don't pretend to be any expert on your situation, but I do follow the news and read that now Brett Kavanaugh is part of the Supreme Court. But this I do know, that your nation is divided. Things are wobbling. The world is wobbling, and it is hesed that stops the wobble. It is hesed that enables us to not act out of anger, to not allow injustice to control us, to not allow something that has violated us to be the determining factor in our lives. It allows us not to demonize those who are against us, not to drive cars into people we disagree with or blow others and ourselves up in protest. Yet this I call to mind. Therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. We will address the issues, but we will not hate or divide or harm. We will not let our grief and our loss turn us to anger. We will not assassinate our opponents with bullets or with words. It's hesed that holds the world steady. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison after 27 years and became the first president of the Democratic South Africa, he chose the route of reconciliation and forgiveness. He stepped into hesed. When Colleen prayed for those who had taken the life of her husband, the father of her children, that was hesed. Let me give you an example which is more closer to home to you than to me, but it was something I read about in our press, and if it got to our press, I'm sure it was very much in your press too. But July 17, 2014, Eric Garner died in Staten Island in New York City. A New York officer, police officer, put him in a chokehold despite Eric Garner saying that he couldn't breathe, and he died in police custody. Do you remember that event? And 2 weeks later, two police officers were murdered when they were sitting in their police car just near where the Eric Garner incident happened. Do you remember that? It was widely reported in our press, and we picked up that things were tense. Things were wobbling. But then there was something else that happened, which wasn't as widely reported, but I heard it reported. That subsequent to this, the wife and the daughter of Eric Garner, who'd been killed in police custody, went and laid wreaths where those two police officers were murdered. They were sliding chesed into a wobbling situation. They were doing chesed. Chesed was a theological principle in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, chesed is a person. And he came to us with wood shavings in his hair and dust on his feet, and he healed the sick and he raised the dead and he gave sight back to the blind, but we crucified chesed. But God had one final act of chesed, the resurrection. The resurrection from the dead. And that gives us hope. That gives us courage. That gives us the audacity to believe, even in the places of desperation. As I draw to a close, let me go back to the story I began with about James and Colleen. It was my great privilege and delight just a year ago come this next Sunday to take the wedding of Colleen, 3 years after James had been killed, to Martin, my friend, Bishop Martin. It's a wonderful story of God's restoration, of God's blessing. And something that struck me that Martin said, it came back to me as I was reading the passages for today. Martin said, after 5 years Sarah's illness and then 8 years being a widower and being a bishop in a demanding ministry, he said, I'd forgotten what it was really like to be happy. And he said, now we feel like teenagers, but with 40 years experience. I don't know where you are this morning. I don't know if you've been waiting 5 years or 8 years or more. But the invitation that we have from our readings this morning is to speak out our pain and our injustice and our anger, to acknowledge that our souls are downcast within. That's reality. But then to land on the other reality, the one that is sure and new every morning, God's chesed will save and is saving and nothing else will. And when we rest in that chesed, when we land and stand on that chesed, then we can do and we can be chesed. Can you imagine? Can you imagine your city? Can you imagine your nation? Can you imagine the world built on chesed, where the wobble is taken out because acts of chesed are being slid under those wobbling tables, and they don't wobble anymore. Can you imagine that? What opportunity is God giving you and me this week to do and to be chesed and to act out of that and not the pain or the injustice that has been done to us? Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. May we who have ears hear what the Spirit says to us through His Word by His living Spirit as we come to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Amen.